east of San Francisco, to scan a million stars. Eventually, the Hat Creek facility may have 350 radio telescopes scanning radio frequencies between 1 and 10 gigahertz. But working on the SETI project is often a thankless task, begging wealthy donors and wary contributors to fund this project. The U.S. Congress has shown only half-hearted interest, and they finally withdrew all financing in 1993, calling it a waste of taxpayer money. In 1978, Senator William Proxmire ridiculed it by awarding it his infamous Golden Fleece Award. Some scientists, frustrated by the lack of funding, have asked the public to participate directly in order to broaden this search. At the University of California, Berkeley, astronomers created SETI at Home, an effort to enlist millions of amateurs online to participate in the search. Anyone can take part. You just download the software from their website. Then, at night, while you sleep, your computer searches through the mountain of data they've collected, hoping to find that needle in the haystack. Dr. Seth Shostak of the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, whom I have interviewed on a number of occasions, believes that we will make contact with an alien civilization before 2025. I asked him how can he be so sure. After all, decades of hard work have not led to a single verified signal from an alien civilization. Furthermore, using radio telescopes to listen in on alien conversations is a bit of a gamble. Maybe the aliens do not use radio. Maybe they use entirely different frequencies, or use laser beams, or an entirely unexpected mode of communication that we haven't thought of. All of these are possible, he admitted, but he was confident that soon we will make contact with alien life. He had the Drake equation on his side. In 1961, astronomer Frank Drake, not satisfied with all the wild speculation about aliens in space, tried to calculate the odds of finding such a civilization. For example, one can start with the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy, about 100 billion, and then reduce that number by the fraction that have planets around them, then by the fraction of the planets that have life on them, then the fraction that have intelligent life, and so on. By multiplying a string of these fractions, one gets a ballpark figure of the possible number of advanced civilizations in the galaxy. When Frank Drake first proposed this formula, there were so many unknowns that the final results were sheer speculation. Estimates of the number of civilizations in the galaxy ranged from tens of thousands to millions. Now, however, with the flood of exoplanets found in space, one can make a much more realistic estimate. The good news is that every year, astronomers narrow down the various components of the Drake equation. We now know that at least one out of every five sun-like stars in the Milky Way galaxy has Earth-like planets circling it. According to the equation, we have more than 20 billion such Earth-like planets in our galaxy. Many more corrections have been made to the Drake equation. The original equation was too naive. As we have seen, we now know that Earth-like planets have to be accompanied by Jupiter-sized planets in circular orbits in order to clean out the asteroids and debris that can destroy life. So we have to reduce the number of Earth-like planets to only those that have Jupiter-sized neighbors. Earth-like planets also have to be accompanied by large moons in order to stabilize their spin, or else they will eventually wobble and even flip over after millions of years. If the moon were tiny, like an asteroid, then small perturbations in the Earth's spin would gradually build up over the eons, according to Newton's laws, and the Earth might eventually flip over. This would be disastrous for life, since there would be giant earthquakes, monstrous tsunamis, and horrendous volcanic eruptions as the crust of the Earth began to crack. Our moon is large enough so that these perturbations do not build up. But Mars, with tiny moons, may actually have flipped over in the distant past. Modern science has given us an ocean of concrete data on how many planets capable of spawning life are out there. But it has also found many more ways in which that life can be extinguished through natural disasters and accidents. There have been many times in the Earth's history when intelligent life was almost extinguished through natural disasters, such as asteroid collisions, planet-wide ice ages, volcanic eruptions. A fundamental question is what percentage of planets that meet these criteria actually have life, and what percentage of those have escaped planetary disasters and spawned intelligent life. So we still are a long way from an accurate assessment of the number of intelligent civilizations in our galaxy. First contact. I asked Dr. Shostak, what happens if the aliens come to Earth? Does the president summon an emergency meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Does the UN draft an announcement welcoming the aliens? What is the protocol when we make first contact? His answer was rather surprising. Basically, there are no protocols. Scientists have conferences in which they discuss this matter, but they only make informal suggestions that have no official weight. No government takes this issue seriously. In any event, first contact will likely be a one-way conversation, with a detector on Earth picking up a stray message from a distant planet. But this does not mean that we can establish communication with them. Such a signal may come from a star system that is, for example, 50 light-years from Earth. So it will take 100 years for a message to be sent to that star and a return message sent back to Earth. This means that communication with an ET in space would be extremely difficult. Assuming that one day they can reach the Earth, a more practical question is, how do we talk to them? What kind of language will they speak? In the movie Arrival, the aliens send huge starships that hover ominously over many nations. When Earthlings enter these starships, they are met by aliens who look like gigantic squids. Attempts to interact with them are difficult, since they communicate by scribbling strange characters on a screen, which linguists struggle to translate. A crisis occurs when the aliens scribble a word that can be read either as tool or weapon. Confused by this ambiguity, the nuclear powers put their weapons on high alert. It seems that an interplanetary war is about to break out, all because of a simple linguistic mistake. In reality, any species advanced enough to send starships to Earth would probably have been monitoring our TV and radio signals and deciphered our language ahead of time, so they would not have to depend on linguists from Earth. But in any case, it would be unwise to start an interplanetary war with aliens that are perhaps millennia more advanced than we are. What happens if the aliens have a totally different frame of reference in their language? If the aliens descended from a race of intelligent dogs, then their language would reflect smells rather than visual images. If they descended from intelligent birds, their language may be based on complex melodies. If they descended from bats or dolphins, their language may use sonar signals. If they descended from insects, they might signal one another via pheromones. Indeed, when we analyze the brains of these animals, we see how much they differ from our own brain. While a large portion of our brain is devoted to eyesight and language, the brains of other animals are devoted to things like smell and sound. In other words, when we make first contact with an alien civilization, we cannot assume that they think and communicate like us. What do they look like? When watching a science fiction movie, the highlight is often when we finally see the aliens. In fact, one of the disappointing features of the otherwise fine movie Contact was that after a tremendous buildup, we never see the aliens themselves. But in the Star Trek series, all the aliens look just like us and talk like us, all speaking perfect American English. The only thing different about them is that they have different types of noses. More imaginative, are the aliens in Star Wars, who look like wild animals or fish, but they always come from planets where they breathe air and have a gravity similar to Earth's. At first, one may say that the aliens can look like anything you want, since we have never made contact with them. But there is a certain logic that they are likely to follow. Although we cannot be sure, there is a high probability that life in outer space might begin in the oceans and be composed of carbon-based molecules. Such chemistry is ideally suited to satisfying two vital criteria for life: the ability to store vast amounts of information because of its complex molecular structure, and the ability to self-replicate. Carbon has four atomic bonds, which allows it to create long chains of hydrocarbons, which include proteins and DNA. These long carbon DNA chains contain a code in the arrangement of their atoms. These chains occur in two strands, which can unravel and then grab molecules to make a copy of themselves according to this code. A new branch of science has recently been born, called exobiology, to study life on distant worlds with ecosystems different from those found on Earth. So far, exobiologists have had difficulty trying to find a path to creating life forms that are not based on the carbon chemistry that gives us rich and diverse molecules. Many other possible life forms have been considered, such as intelligent balloon-like creatures floating in the atmosphere of the gas giants. But it is hard to create a realistic chemistry that makes such creatures possible. When I was a child, one of my favorite movies was Forbidden Planet, which taught me a valuable scientific lesson. On a distant world, astronauts are terrorized by a huge monster that is killing crew members. A scientist takes a plaster mold of the tracks it left behind in the soil. He is shocked by what he finds. The monster's feet, he declares, violate all the laws of evolution. The claws, the toes, bones are all arranged in a way that makes no sense. This caught my attention. A monster violating the laws of evolution? This was a new concept to me, that even monsters and aliens have to obey the laws of science. Previously, I thought that monsters just had to be ferocious and ugly. But it made perfect sense that monsters and aliens would have to obey the same natural laws that we do. They do not live in a vacuum. For example, when I hear about the Loch Ness Monster, I have to ask, what would be the breeding population of such a creature? If a dinosaur-like creature could exist in that lake, it must be part of a breeding population of perhaps 50 or so other creatures. In that case, evidence of these creatures, in the form of bones, carcasses of its prey, waste products, etc., should be readily found. The fact that no such evidence has been discovered casts doubt on their existence. Similarly, one should be able to apply the laws of evolution to aliens in space. It is impossible to tell precisely how an alien civilization might emerge on a distant planet. We can make some inferences, however, based on our own evolution. When we analyze how Homo sapiens developed intelligence, we see at least three components that were essential in our rise from the swamp. 1. Some form of stereo eyes. In general, predators are more intelligent than prey. To hunt effectively, one has to be a master of stealth, cunning, strategy, camouflage, and deception. One also has to know the habits of the prey, where they feed, what their weaknesses are, what their defenses are. All this takes some brain power. On the other hand, all prey have to do is run. This is reflected in their eyes. Hunters, like tigers and foxes, have eyes facing the front of their face, which gives them stereo vision, as the brain compares images from the left and right eyes. This allows them to judge distance, which is essential in locating the prey. However, prey do not need stereo vision. All they need is 360-degree vision to to scan for the presence of predators, and hence they have eyes on each side of their face, like deer and rabbits. In all likelihood, intelligent aliens in space will have descended from predators that hunted for their food. This does not necessarily mean that they will be aggressive, but it does mean that their ancestors long ago might have been predators. We may be well served to be cautious. 2. Some form of opposable thumb or grasping appendage. One hallmark of a species that could develop an intelligent civilization is the ability to manipulate the environment. Instead of plants, which are at the mercy of changes in their surroundings, intelligent animals can shape their environment to increase their chances of survival. One thing that set humans apart is the opposable thumb, which gives us the ability to use our hands to exploit tools. Previously, the hand was used mainly to swing from tree branches, and the arc created by our index finger and thumb is roughly the size of a tree branch in Africa. This does not mean that opposable thumbs are the only grasping instrument that could lead to intelligence. Tentacles and claws may also suffice. So the combination of the first and second criteria gives the animal the ability to use hand-eye coordination to hunt for prey and also to manipulate tools. But the third criterion ties it all together. 3. Language. Among most species, any lesson an individual might learn dies with that animal. In order to hand down and accumulate essential information from generation to generation, some form of language is crucial. The more abstract the language, the more information can be conveyed between generations. Being a hunter helps encourage the evolution of language, because pack predators have to communicate and coordinate with one another. Language is primarily useful for pack animals. While a single hunter may be crushed by a mastodon, a group of hunters can ambush, surround, trap, snare, and bring down a mastodon. Furthermore, language is necessarily a social phenomenon that accelerates the development of cooperation among individuals. This was an essential ingredient in the rise of human civilization. I had a graphic example of the social aspects of language when I swam in a pool full of playful dolphins for a TV program with the Discovery Channel. Inserted in the pool were sonic sensors that recorded the chirps and whistles that they used to communicate with one another. Although they don't have a written language, they have an audible one, which can be recorded and analyzed. Then, using a computer, one can look for patterns that indicate intelligence. For example, if one randomly analyzes the English language, one finds that the letter E is the most common letter in the alphabet. One can then compile a list of letters and analyze how frequently each one is used, providing a distinctive fingerprint for that language or a particular person. This can be used to trace the authorship of historical manuscripts, to show, for example, that Shakespeare really did write his plays. Similarly, one can record the communications between the dolphins and find that the repetition of their chirps and whistles obeys a mathematical formula. One can then analyze the language of a number of other species, such as dogs and cats, and find a similar telltale sign of intelligence. However, as we start to analyze the sounds of insects, we find less and less evidence of intelligence. The point is that animals do have primitive languages, and computers can mathematically calculate their complexity. Evolution of intelligence on Earth. So, if at least three attributes are necessary for the development of intelligent life, then we can ask, how many animals on the Earth have all three of them? We find that many predators with stereoscopic vision have claws, paws, fangs, or tentacles, but lack the ability to grasp tools. Similarly, None have a sophisticated language that allows them to hunt, share information with others, and hand information down to the next generation. We can also compare human evolution and intelligence with those of the dinosaurs. Although our understanding of dinosaur intelligence is extremely limited, it is believed that they dominated the Earth for about 200 million years. Yet none of them became intelligent or developed a dinosaur civilization, which took humans only about 200,000 years. But if we analyze the dinosaur kingdom carefully, we see signs that intelligence might have flourished. For example, the velociraptors, immortalized in Jurassic Park, probably could have become intelligent with time. They had the stereo eyes of a hunter. They hunted in packs, which meant they probably had some communication system between them to coordinate the hunt. And they had claws for grasping prey, which might have evolved into opposable thumbs. By contrast, the limbs of the Tyrannosaurus rex were tiny, probably used only to grab the flesh after the hunt was over, and unlikely to be of much use in grasping tools. The T-Rex was essentially a walking mouth. Aliens from Star Maker. Given this framework, we can analyze the aliens found in Olaf Stapledon's Star Maker. The hero of that story takes an imaginary journey across the universe, encountering scores of fascinating civilizations. We see the panorama of possible intelligence spread across the canvas of the whole Milky Way galaxy. One alien species evolved on a planet with a large gravitational field. Hence, instead of four legs, they required six legs to walk. Eventually, the front two legs evolved into hands, freeing them up to use tools. Over time, this animal evolved into something resembling a centaur. He meets aliens that are insect-like. Although each insect is not intelligent, the combination of billions of them creates a collective intelligence. A bird-like race flies in gigantic swarms like a cloud and also develops a hive mind. He meets intelligent plant-like creatures that, during the day, are inert like plants, but at night can move like animals. He even meets intelligent life forms that are totally outside our experience, such as intelligent stars. Many of these alien creatures live in the oceans. One of the most successful of these aquatic species is a symbiosis of two different life forms, resembling a fish and a crab. With the crab riding behind the fish's head, they can travel rapidly like a fish, and the crab can manipulate tools using its claws. This combination gives them a tremendous advantage as they become the dominant species on their planet. Eventually, the crab-like creatures venture onto the land, where they invent machines, electrical appliances, rocket ships, and a utopian society based on prosperity, science, and progress. These symbiotic creatures develop starships and encounter less advanced civilizations. Stapledon writes, "Great care was taken by the symbiotic race to keep its existence hidden from the primitives, lest they should lose their independence." In other words, although the fish and the crab separately could not evolve into a higher creature, the combination of the two could. Given that the vast majority of alien civilizations, if they exist, may live underwater on ice-covered moons, like Europa or Enceladus, or on the moons of rogue planets, the question is, can an aquatic species become truly intelligent? If we analyze our own oceans, we see several problems. Fins are an extremely efficient way of traveling in the oceans, while feet and hands are not. One can travel and maneuver quite quickly with fins, while moving with feet on the ocean floor is clumsy and awkward. Not surprisingly, in the oceans we see few animals that have evolved appendages that can be used to grasp tools. So creatures with fins are unlikely to become intelligent, unless the fins somehow evolve so they can grasp objects Or else these fins were actually arms and legs of land animals that returned to the oceans, like dolphins and whales. However, the octopus is a very successful animal. Having survived for at least 300 million years, it is perhaps the most intelligent of all invertebrates. When we analyze the octopus with regard to our criteria, we find that it matches two out of three of them. First, being a predator, it has the eyes of a hunter. However, its two eyes do not focus stereoscopically well toward the front. Second, its eight tentacles give it an extraordinary ability to manipulate objects in its environment. These tentacles have remarkable dexterity. But it has no language to speak of. Being a solitary hunter, there is no need to communicate with others. There is also no interaction between generations as far as we can tell. Thus, the octopus displays a certain intelligence. They are notorious for being able to escape from aquariums, taking full advantage of their soft bodies to squeeze through tiny cracks. They can also navigate through mazes, showing they possess some form of memory, and they have been known to manipulate tools. One octopus was able to grab coconut shells and create a shelter for itself. So, if the octopus has some limited intelligence and versatile tentacles, then why didn't it become intelligent? Ironically, it's probably a testament to its success. Hiding under a rock and grabbing prey with its tentacles is a very successful strategy. So octopi probably had no need to develop intelligence. In other words, there was no evolutionary pressure placed on them to evolve greater intelligence. However, on a distant planet under different conditions, one can imagine that an octopus-like creature could develop a language of chirps and whistles so it could hunt in packs. Perhaps the beak of the octopus can evolve to produce the rudiments of language. One could even imagine that at some point in the distant future, evolutionary pressures on Earth could force the octopus to develop intelligence. So an intelligent race of octopods is certainly a possibility. Another intelligent creature envisioned by Stapledon was a bird. Scientists have noticed that birds, like the octopods, have significant intelligence. Unlike the octopus, however, they have a very sophisticated way of communicating with one another, through chirps and also through songs and melodies. By recording the songs of certain birds, scientists have noticed that the more sophisticated and melodic the song, the greater the attraction from the opposite sex. In other words, the complexity of a male bird's song allows the female bird to judge its health, its strength, and its suitability as a mate. So there is an evolutionary pressure on them to develop complex melodies and a certain intelligence. Although some birds have the stereo eyes of a hunter, such as hawks and owls, and a form of language, they lack the ability to manipulate the environment. Millions of years ago, some of the animals that walked on four legs evolved into birds. By analyzing the bones of birds, we see precisely how the bones of the legs slowly evolved into the bones of the wing. There is a one-to-one match between the two sets of bones. But to truly manipulate the environment, one would want animals whose hands are free to grasp tools. This means that intelligent birds will either have to evolve modified wings that have a dual purpose, allowing both flight and the manipulation of tools, or they need to start with at least six legs, four of which eventually become wings and hands. So an intelligent species of birds is possible, if they could somehow develop the ability to manipulate tools. These are just a few examples of how varied intelligent species might be. There are certainly many other possibilities one could contemplate. Human intelligence. It is illustrative to ask, why did we become intelligent? Many primates come close to satisfying all three criteria, So why did we develop these abilities rather than chimpanzees, bonobos, our closest evolutionary relative, or gorillas? When we measure Homo sapiens against other animals, we see that we are weak and clumsy by comparison. We might easily be the laughingstock of the animal kingdom. We can't run very fast. We have no talons or claws. We cannot fly. We don't have a keen sense of smell. We have no armor. We aren't very strong. And our skin has no fur and is quite delicate. In every category, we see that there are animals that are vastly superior physically. In fact, most animals we see around us are very successful and hence had no evolutionary pressure to change. Some animals haven't changed for millions of years. Precisely because we are weak and clumsy, we were under enormous pressure to acquire skills the other primates lacked. To compensate for our deficiencies, we had to become intelligent. One theory states that the climate in East Africa began to change several million years ago, causing the forests to recede and the grasslands to spread. Our ancestors were forest creatures, so many of them died off when the trees began to disappear. Those who did survive were forced to move from the forests onto the savanna and grasslands. They had to wrench their backs and walk upright, allowing them to see above the grass. We see evidence of this in our sway back, which puts enormous pressure on the small of our back. This is the reason why back problems are one of the most common health issues facing middle-aged people. Walking upright had another great advantage. It freed up our hands so we could manipulate tools. When we encounter intelligent aliens in space, chances are good that they too will be clumsy and weak and will have compensated for these deficiencies by evolving intelligence. And they, like us, will evolve the ability to survive by a new technique, the ability to alter their environment at will. Evolving on different planets. So then, how might an intelligent creature develop a modern technological society? As we've discussed, the most common form of life in the galaxy might be aquatic. We've already looked at whether sea creatures can develop the requisite physiology, but there is a cultural and technological component to our story as well. So let us see if an advanced civilization can rise from the bottom of the ocean. For humans, after the discovery of agriculture, this process of developing energy and information went through three stages. The first stage was the Industrial Revolution, when the energy of our hands was magnified many times by the power of coal and fossil fuels. Society exploded with power, converting a primitive agrarian culture into an industrial one. The second stage was the Electric Age, when the power available to us was augmented by electric generators and new forms of communication arose, including radio, TV, and telecommunications. As a result, both energy and information flourished. The third stage is the Information Revolution, when computer power came to dominate society. We can now ask the simple question, can an aquatic alien civilization also go through these three stages of development in energy and information? Because Europa and Enceladus are so far from the sun, and since their oceans are perpetually under an ice cover, any intelligent creature on these distant moons will probably be blind, like the fish who live in dark caves beneath the surface of the earth. Instead, they will probably develop some form of sonar, using sound waves as bats do, in order to navigate the oceans. But since the wavelength of light is so much smaller than the wavelength of sound, it means that they will not be able to see the fine details that we can with our eyes. Just as sonograms used by doctors provide far less detail than endoscopy. This will slow down their march toward creating a modern civilization. But more important, any aquatic species will have a problem with energy. Since you cannot burn fossil fuels in water, and it's difficult to shield electrical power, Most industrial machinery would be useless without oxygen to create combustion and mechanical motion. Solar power would also be useless, since sunlight would not penetrate the perpetual ice cover. Without internal combustion engines, fires, and solar power, it would seem that any alien aquatic species would lack the energy to develop into a modern society. There is one source of untapped energy that is available to them, however, and that is geothermal energy coming from heat vents on the bottom of the ocean. Like the volcanic vents on the bottom of our own oceans, similar vents on Europa and Enceladus may provide a convenient energy source for tools. It might be possible to create an underwater steam engine as well. The temperature of the vents might be well beyond the boiling point of water. If the heat from these vents can be channeled, then creatures might be able to use it to create a steam engine, using a system of pipes that can draw boiling water from these vents and then channel it to move a piston. From this, they might be able to enter the machine age. It might also be possible to use this heat to melt ores in order to create a metallurgy. If they can extract and mold metal, then they can create cities on the bottom of their oceans. In short, it may be possible to create an underwater industrial revolution. An electric revolution seems improbable, since water would short-circuit most traditional electrical appliances. Without electricity, all the wonders of that age would be impossible, so their technology would be stunted. But here also, there is a possible solution. If these creatures can find magnetized iron on the bottom of the oceans, then it's possible to create an electrical generator, which then can be used to power machinery. By spinning these magnets, perhaps by jets of steam hitting a turbine blade, they could push electrons in a wire, creating an electrical current. This is the same process used in bicycle lamps and hydroelectric dams. The point is that intelligent underwater creatures might be able to create electric generators using magnets even in the presence of water, and hence enter the electric age. The information revolution with computers is also difficult, but not impossible to master for an aquatic species. Just as water is the perfect medium to spawn life, silicon is also the likely basis for any chip-based computer technology. There could be silicon on the bottom of the ocean, which can be mined, purified, and etched to create chips via ultraviolet light, just as we do. To create silicon chips, UV light is passed through a template that contains the blueprint for all the circuits on a chip. The UV light and a series of chemical reactions creates a pattern that is etched onto a silicon wafer, creating transistors on the chip. This process, which is the basis of transistor technology, can also be done underwater. So it would be possible for an aquatic creature to develop intelligence and to create a modern technological society. Natural barriers to an alien technology. Once a civilization begins the long, arduous process of becoming a modern society, it faces yet another problem. There may be a series of natural phenomena that get in the way. For example, if intelligent creatures evolved on a place like Venus or Titan, they may be faced with a permanent cloud cover over their world, so they would never see the stars. Their concept of the universe would be limited to their planet. This means that their civilization will never develop astronomy, and their religion would consist of tales that are confined to their planet. Since they will have no urge to explore beyond the clouds, their civilization will also be stunted, and it is highly unlikely they will develop a space program. Without a space program, they would never have telecommunication and weather satellites. In Stapledon's novel, some creatures living beneath the surface of the sea eventually came onto land, where they discovered astronomy. If they had stayed in the oceans, they would never have discovered the universe beyond their planet. Yet another problem facing a developed society was outlined in Asimov's award-winning story, Nightfall, where he envisioned scientists living on a planet that revolves around six stars. The planet is continually bathed in starlight. Its habitants, who have never seen the night sky with its billions of stars, firmly believe that the entire universe just consists of their solar system. Their entire religion and sense of identity centers around this core belief. But then scientists begin to make a series of disturbing discoveries. They find that every 2,000 years, their civilization collapses into total chaos. Something mysterious happens to spark the total disintegration of their society. This cycle seems to repeat unending into the past. There are legends that people went insane because everything went dark. People lit huge bonfires to light up the sky until entire cities went up in flames. Bizarre religious cults spread, governments collapsed, and normal society disintegrated. Then it would take 2,000 years before a new civilization could rise from the ashes of the previous one. Then scientists realize the sickening truth behind their past, that every 2,000 years there is an anomaly in their own planet's orbit, so that it experiences nightfall. And to their horror, they find that this cycle will happen again very soon. As the story ends, nightfall begins once again, and civilization descends into chaos. Stories like Nightfall force us to contemplate how life may exist on planets under a totally different set of circumstances from our own. We are lucky to live on the Earth, where energy sources are plentiful, where fire and combustion are possible, where the atmosphere allows electrical devices to function without short circuits, where silicon is plentiful, and where we can see the night sky. If any of these ingredients were missing, it would make the rise of an advanced civilization very difficult. Fermi paradox. Where are they? But all this still leaves one persistent, nagging question, which is the Fermi paradox. Where are they? If they exist, then surely they would leave a mark, maybe even visit us. Yet we see no real evidence of an alien visitation. There are many possible solutions to this paradox. My thinking is as follows. If they have the ability to actually reach the planet Earth from hundreds of light years away, then their technology is much more advanced than ours. In that case, we are arrogant to believe that they would travel trillions of miles to visit a backward civilization with nothing to offer. After all, when we visit the forest, do we try to talk to the deer and the squirrels? Maybe initially we might try, but since they don't talk back, we would quickly lose interest and leave. So for the most part, the aliens would leave us alone, looking at us as a primitive curiosity. Or as Olaf Stapledon speculated decades ago, perhaps they have a policy not to interfere with primitive civilizations. In other words, they might be aware of us, but don't want to influence our development. Stapledon gives us another possibility as he writes, "Some of these pre-utopian worlds, not malignant but incapable of further advance, were left in peace and preserved, as we preserve wild animals in national parks for scientific interest." When I asked Dr. Shostak this question, he gave me an entirely different answer. He said that a civilization more advanced than ours will most likely develop artificial intelligence, so they would send robots into space. "We shouldn't be surprised," he told me, "if the aliens that we finally meet are mechanical rather than biological. In movies like Blade Runner, robots are sent into outer space to do the dirty work, since space exploration is difficult and dangerous. That, in turn, may explain why we don't pick up their radio emissions. If the aliens follow our own technological path, they will invent robots soon after they invent radio. Once they enter the age of artificial intelligence, they might merge with their robots and have little use for radio anymore. For example, a civilization of robots may be wired up with cables rather than radio or microwave antennas. Such a civilization would be invisible to the radio receivers of the SETI project. In other words, an alien civilization may only have a few centuries in which they use radio. So perhaps that is one reason why we don't pick up transmissions. Others have speculated that maybe they would want to plunder something from our planet. One possibility is the liquid water from our oceans. Liquid water is indeed a precious commodity in our solar system, found only on the Earth and the moons of the gas giants, but ice is not. There's plenty of ice out there on comets, asteroids, and the moons orbiting the gas giants, so all an alien civilization has to do is heat up the ice. There is another possibility, that maybe they would want to steal valuable minerals from the Earth. This is certainly possible, but there are plenty of uninhabited worlds out there with precious minerals. If an alien civilization has the technology to reach the Earth from vast distances, then they would have a selection of planets to exploit. And it would be far easier to strip a planet that is uninhabited than one with intelligent life. Another possibility is that they want to steal the heat from the core of the Earth, which would destroy the entire planet. But we suspect that an advanced civilization has harnessed the power of fusion, and hence there is no need to steal the heat from the core of the Earth. Hydrogen, the fuel for fusion plants, is, after all, the most plentiful element in the entire universe, and they can always capture energy from stars, which are also plentiful. Are we in their way? In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the aliens want to get rid of us because we are simply in the way. The bureaucrats among the aliens have nothing against us personally, but we are an obstacle that had to be removed so they can create an intergalactic bypass. This is a real possibility. For example, who is more dangerous to a deer? A hungry hunter armed with a powerful rifle, or a mild-mannered developer with a briefcase who needs land for a housing tract? The hunter may seem more dangerous to a single deer, but ultimately the developer is more lethal to the species, wiping out an entire forest full of creatures. In the same way, the Martians in the War of the Worlds did not have a grudge against Earthlings. Their world was dying, so they needed to take over ours. They did not hate humans, we were simply in the way. The same reasoning is found in the previously discussed Superman movie, Man of Steel, in which the DNA of the entire population of Krypton was preserved just before their home planet exploded. They need to take over the Earth to resurrect their race. Although this scenario is certainly plausible, again, there are other planets to plunder and take over, so one can hope that the aliens would pass us by. My colleague, Paul Davies, raises yet another possibility. Maybe their technology is so advanced that they can create virtual reality programs that are far superior to reality, so that they prefer to live perpetually in a fantastic video game. This possibility is not so illogical, because even among humans, a certain fraction of our population would prefer to live in a hazy, drug-fueled state rather than face reality. In our world, this is an unsustainable option, because society would fall apart if everyone were on drugs. But if machines satisfy all our worldly needs, then a parasitic society is possible. But all this speculation still leaves open the question, what will an advanced civilization, perhaps thousands to millions of years more advanced than ours, look like? Will meeting them usher in a new era of peace and prosperity, or annihilation? It is impossible to predict the culture, politics, and society of an advanced civilization. But, as I mentioned, there is one thing that even they will have to obey. The laws of physics. So what does physics say about how a super-advanced civilization will evolve? And if we do not encounter any advanced civilizations in our sector of the galaxy, then how might we advance into the future? Will we be able to explore the stars and eventually the galaxy? Some scientists have proposed adding the category of a Type 4 civilization that controls space-time well enough to affect the entire universe. Why stop at one universe? Chris Impey. There is something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. Mark Twain. Chapter 13. Advanced Civilizations. The tabloid headlines blared, "Giant alien megastructure found in space. Astronomers baffled by alien machine in space." Even the Washington Post, not used to running lurid stories on UFOs and aliens, ran the headline, "The weirdest star in the sky is acting up again." Suddenly, astronomers who normally analyze boring reams of data from satellites and radio telescopes were flooded with calls from anxious journalists, asking if it was true that they had finally found an alien structure in space. This caught them by surprise. The astronomical community was at a loss for words. Yes, something strange had been discovered in space. Yes, it defied explanation, but it was too soon to say what it meant. This might just be a wild goose chase. The controversy began when astronomers were looking at exoplanets transiting distant stars. Usually, a giant Jupiter-sized exoplanet moving in front of its mother star will dim its starlight by 1% or so. But one day, they were analyzing the data from the Kepler spacecraft concerning the star KIC 8462852, which is about 1,400 light-years from Earth. They found an astonishing anomaly. Something had dimmed the starlight by a massive 15% in 2011. These anomalies can usually be dismissed. Perhaps there was something wrong with the instruments, a spike in power, a transient surge in electrical output, or perhaps it was nothing but dust on the telescope mirrors. But then it was observed a second time in 2013, this time dimming the star's light by 22%. Nothing known to science can dim starlight regularly by that amount. "We'd never seen anything like this star. It was really weird," said Tabitha Boyajian, a postdoctoral fellow at Yale. The situation became even more bizarre when Bradley Schaefer of Louisiana State University searched old photographic plates and found that the star's light has been dimming periodically since 1890. Astronomy Now magazine wrote that this has triggered a frenzy of observations as astronomers hurry to try to get to the bottom of what is rapidly becoming one of the biggest mysteries in astronomy. So astronomers made long lists of possible explanations, but one by one, doubt was cast on the usual scientific suspects. What could possibly cause this massive dip in starlight? Could it really be something 22 times larger than Jupiter? One possibility was that it was caused by a planet plunging into the star. But that was ruled out because the anomaly kept reappearing. Another possibility was the dust from the disk of the solar system. As a solar system condenses in space, the original disk of gas and dust can be many times larger than the sun itself. So maybe the dimming of starlight occurred because the disk passed in front of the star. But this was ruled out when analyzing the star itself, which was found to be mature. The dust should have long since condensed or been swept into space by the solar winds. After discarding a number of possible solutions, there was still one option that could not be easily dismissed. No one wanted to believe it, but it could not be ruled out. Maybe it was a colossal megastructure built by an alien intelligence. Aliens should always be the very last hypothesis you consider. But this looked like something you would expect an alien civilization to build, says Jason Wright, an astronomer from Penn State University. Since the time elapsed between Dipson Starlight in 2011 and 2013 was 750 days, astronomers predicted that it would recur again in May 2017. Right on schedule, the star began to dim. This time, practically every telescope on Earth capable of measuring starlight was tracking the star. Astronomers from around the world witnessed the star dimming by 3% and then brightening again. But what could it be? Some thought it might be a Dyson sphere, first proposed by Olaf Stapledon in 1937, but later analyzed by physicist Freeman Dyson. A Dyson sphere is a gigantic sphere around a star, designed to harvest the energy from its massive amounts of starlight. Or it could be a huge sphere orbiting a star that periodically passes in front of the star, causing starlight to dim. Perhaps this was something created in order to power the machines of an advanced Type II civilization. This last supposition tweaked the imagination of amateurs and journalists alike. They asked, what is a Type II civilization? Kardashev Scale of Civilizations. This classification of advanced civilizations was first proposed by Russian astronomer Nikolai Kardashev in 1964. He was not satisfied looking for alien civilizations without any idea of what he might be searching for. Scientists like to quantify the unknown. So he introduced a scale that ranked civilizations on the basis of energy consumption. Different ones might have different cultures, politics, and history, but all of them would require energy. His ranking was as follows. 1. A Type 1 civilization utilizes all the energy of the sunlight that falls on that planet. 2. A Type 2 civilization utilizes all the energy its sun produces. 3. A Type 3 civilization utilizes the energy of an entire galaxy. In this way, Kardashev conveniently gave a simple method for computing and ranking the possible civilizations within the galaxy, based on energy use. Each civilization, in turn, has an energy consumption that can be computed. It is easy to calculate how much sunlight falls on a square foot of land on Earth. Multiplying this by the surface area of the Earth illuminated by the sun, and one immediately calculates the approximate energy of an average Type 1 civilization. We find that a Type 1 civilization harnesses the power of 7 times 10 to the 17th watts, which is about 100,000 times the energy output of the Earth today. Since we know the fraction of the sun's energy that falls on the Earth, we can then multiply to include the surface area of the entire sun, and we get its total energy output, which is roughly 4 times 10 to the 26th watts. This tells us roughly how much energy is utilized in a Type 2 civilization. We also know how many stars there are in the Milky Way galaxy, so we can multiply by this number and find the energy output of an entire galaxy, giving us the energy consumption of a Type 3 civilization in our galaxy, which is roughly 4 times 10 to the 37th watts. The results were intriguing. Kardashev found that each civilization was greater than the previous one by a factor of between 10 billion and 100 billion. One can then mathematically compute when we might rise up this scale. Using the total energy consumption of the planet Earth, we find that we are currently a Type 0.7 civilization. Assuming a 2% to 3% annual increase in energy output, which roughly corresponds to the current average growth rate, or annual growth in GDP for the planet, we are about a century or two away from becoming a Type 1 civilization. rising to the level of a Type II civilization could take a few thousand years, according to this calculation. When we would become a Type III civilization is more difficult to compute, since it involves advances in